afternoon. You're welcome to see it.
All right, this is the time set for docket number 87032. Our argument is set for 34 minutes, 17 per side. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. How much time would appellant like to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
Okay. And you can go ahead whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Your Honors. May it please the court. Corey Corbridge for the appellant. The district court misapplied authenticity and disclosure rules, which led to the exclusion of the most important element of our defense at trial. Authenticity is a simple test. Is the evidence what the proponent claims it is? Plaintiff never argued that the medical records at issue here were anything other than real. We know that because plaintiff is the one who identified these medical records by producing them in discovery. That was enough to satisfy the authentication requirement. The aim of disclosure is also simple. Has fair notice been given to the other party of what the evidence is in the case? Here, the 2017 medical records were a focal point of the defense, and they were disclosed to the plaintiff years before trial. So when the district court excluded those medical records, it paved the way, really, for the jury to award a multi-million dollar verdict without ever considering evidence that the plaintiff's condition pre-existed the accident at issue in this case. So unless the court's attention is elsewhere, I'd like to start with the authentication requirement and then respond to plaintiff's disclosure requirements. I'd also like to save a little time at the end to address attorney's fees, even though I don't think the court reaches that issue here if it awards a new trial. So the district court created an artificial requirement by requiring the defense to comply with NRS 52.325 in order to introduce these medical records. Authentication isn't supposed to be tricky. The question is the evidence real? And when a plaintiff produces documents in discovery, the opposing party has the right to assume and presume that those documents are real. Otherwise, discovery wouldn't work if you have to question everything I get from the other side, is it real or is it fake? And so here, we asked plaintiff for any medical records from any prior accident. And plaintiff responded, I am producing documents relating to my prior accident as exhibit one to this response. And those are the documents that we then gave to our experts who relied on to make opinions. They were discussed in different depositions. They were discussed in an independent medical exam with the plaintiff. And so all throughout this case, we're relying on the authenticity of these medical records. And if it wasn't enough that plaintiff produced them, the trial counsel actually did send the same medical records to the custodian of records. Align Med is primarily the provider at issue here, and asked them, hey, can we get a certificate of authenticity for these records? And Align Med sent back a certificate of authenticity for the records. So not only were these produced by plaintiff, but then the extra step was actually made to go send them to the medical provider who certified that they're authentic. And to require anything more than that is really empty formalities, empty procedural hurdles.
Counsel, can I just ask a quick question? So the documents evidencing the prior injury were excluded. Were you also restrained from asking questions about the prior injury or bringing up the prior accident?
Yes. So there was a motion in limine before trial to exclude any prior accidents, and we responded by saying, no, there's a 2017 accident mm-hmm. where the plaintiff was injured. It's the same level of the neck that was injured, mm-hmm. the same treatments recommended. We have to be able to get into that. And the court agreed and said this is relevant, but authenticity was kind of lingering in the background at that point. And the court said, it's relevant, you can get into it, but you're going to have to authenticate it at trial. And that's when defense counsel actually went and got the certificate of authenticity from the medical provider. Now, once we got the records back and we tried to introduce them before trial, the district court said, well, they're not a complete set of the records. You're missing the last visit. And so the district court said, well, then that's not a proper NRS 52.325 affidavit. It's an incomplete set, so you can't use these records. Now, by extension, if we can't use the records, then there's no expert testimony to connect those records to the injuries in this case. Mm-hmm. So if we would have asked the plaintiff about the prior accident, the objection is there's no expert to connect the prior accident to this accident.
Understood. Thank you.
Counsel, if these records were so important to your client, why didn't they, you know, list them as an exhibit?
We did. So
tell me how.
Yeah, right. So in multiple ways. So I think there's also a distinction between, so you're talking about pretrial disclosures. So
I am talking about pretrial disclosures.
So our pretrial disclosures listed a line who's the medical provider as a witness at trial. And so, and we listed them as a witness at trial to discuss the authenticity of the records. So that's the first way that these were disclosed. The second way is that Dr. Wang and Dr. Kusera were our experts in the case. They listed each one of these records in their reports. And so our reports are listed as exhibits in our pretrial disclosures. And NRS 16.1 contemplates disclosure by expert report. So in 16.1, so there's 16.1 initial disclosures, expert disclosures, pretrial disclosures. And in our expert reports, both Dr. Wang and Dr. Kusera are relying on these medical records extensively. It's all throughout their reports. And I also, so you're not gonna like this answer, but we also did identify all documents disclosed in discovery.
You're right, I don't like so, that.
but here's an important note that plaintiff actually disclosed these in plaintiff's pretrial disclosures. So plaintiff also lists Align Med. Plaintiff also lists the medical and billing records from Align Med as exhibits. And importantly, plaintiff discloses, and this is in the first volume at page 29 and then again at page 159, any medical records so plaintiff disclosed, plaintiff may offer documents produced by plaintiff and defendant in which experts have reviewed and formed an opinion based on each document, including but not limited to medical records. So that's actually plaintiff's pretrial disclosure saying we're going to use as an exhibit anything that an expert relied on.
It is my understanding that when it came time for the parties to exchange their actual exhibits, that's when your client had included a copy of these records as one of the proposed exhibits. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
And how far before trial was that?
So that they were sent in that form, it was right before the Rule 2.67 conference, which I think is in this case it happened the week before trial. But there's not any dispute that plaintiff knew that we were relying on these records. So the records were first given to the defense in June of 2020. The trial in this case was April 2023. So we make a request for production. Plaintiff gives us these documents in response. 2 months after that, there's an independent medical exam of the plaintiff. And in that, the plaintiff's asked about this 2017 accident. Dr. Wang's independent medical exam lists all the records from that 2017 accident as being reviewed. And then you have a couple months after that, there's a report from Dr. Kusera, where he's again listing all of these records. Plaintiff was asked about these at her deposition. Dr. Wang was asked about the records at his deposition. This is all happening years before trial. So it's no secret to anybody that these documents are the focal point of our case.
What effect, if any, is there from the missing final visit?
Well, I think the first question is to ask why there is a missing visit, and it was plaintiff who didn't disclose a full, complete set of the records. So we asked for the records. Plaintiff said, these are the records. It was missing one page. Now, we didn't know that until right before trial. Defense counsel put everything together and realized we're missing that one date. So I think that gets into the idea of completeness versus authenticity. And authenticity is a simple question: is this real evidence? Completeness is, would it be misleading to give the jury this evidence without something more? Is there more context? And to focus on completeness here would be an error, because I think the question, the remedy for a completeness violation is not to exclude the records you do have. You consider, what do I do with this one record I didn't have? Does it need to be excluded? Can both the parties incorporate it into their arguments, into their expert reports? Is it too late to do that? Are we going to issue a discovery violation to the plaintiff for not disclosing that record in response, or supplementing once the plaintiff found out that the response was incomplete? So I think there's different remedies. And here, the district court conflated completeness with authenticity, and it did that while interpreting NRS 52.325, which is a statute really that allows medical providers to prevent having to come to court to testify and authenticate their medical records.
But so if your experts got on the stand and offered opinions that some of the current claimed treatment or injuries were tied to this 2017 accident as opposed to the 2019 one, and relying in part on these 2017 medical records, they could have been cross-examined about not having seen that final visit note regarding maximum medical improvement to call into question their opinions, correct?
In fact, they were at an evidentiary hearing before trial, and Dr. Wang explained how that record would change his opinions. And he actually, I think it was beneficial to some of his opinions, because it shows, so maximum medical improvement doesn't mean plaintiff's all better. In that record, plaintiff is still complaining about pain, and plaintiff also has arm pain, which were big issues at trial. So I have just one minute before I want to save time for rebuttal, and I don't think attorney's fees are going to come up, but if I don't make the argument, Dan's going to jump up here and do it for
me. Can I just ask one question before you jump into fees? Are you promoting that we adopt like a rebuttable presumption of authenticity if it is the party opponent who in fact produces the documents during discovery?
I think that's exactly right, and that's a common rule that courts accept, and it's also supported by NRS 52.015 section 3, which allows a party. So if there was a problem with something I produced in discovery, it's not the end of the world. I can present additional evidence to say that's actually not a real document.
Okay. Understood.
Are you going to jump up if I don't do attorney's fees? I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Tom Stewart for Rosa Herrera. So 4 months ago, in Talley versus State, the court reaffirmed the important procedural safeguards that authentication provides the judicial process. Went on to say that now more than ever, those safeguards are important, presumably because of the proliferation of things like, you know, AI and manipulative technology. But in any event, the safeguards remain important. And adopting a rule that permits the authentication of evidence without any showing of personal knowledge on behalf of the offering party erodes and in many cases eliminates those safeguards. Excuse me. It also runs contrary to longstanding rules and tenets of evidence. The first is, of course, personal knowledge, which doesn't just underlie authentication. It underlies every condition precedent to admissibility of both documentary and testimonial evidence. The second is that it removes the offering party's burden of proof to produce a document that was simply provided during discovery. And along those same lines, it eliminates the district court's discretion to consider whether personal knowledge has been shown merely because a document was attached to an unverified discovery response. So if authentication is as important now than ever, the court should reject that and should affirm the judgment in full. But the procedural posture of this case means the court never has to answer that question. Mr. Gutierrez didn't challenge most of the substantive findings, especially those made under 60B and 59E, which in many ways preclude the district court's grant of a new trial. Even before that, I think Judge Cage's question was, if these were so important, why were they never disclosed? The district court found repeated violations of not just 16.1A3, the pretrial rule, but 16.1A1. And Mr. Gutierrez never timely argued that his failure to abide by those rules and those repeated violations were either harmless or justified, or that disclosure wasn't otherwise necessary.
But counsel, your client wouldn't produce inauthentic documents, would she?
The question that the court has always grappled with is not so much the inherent authentication or falseness of the record. In Sanders and in Frias, the question was, what process took place to ensure that these were accurate? Because, so Rosa is a Mexican citizen who speaks Spanish. She has no idea whether her chiropractor's prior records are accurately reflecting that they're English language records of Spanish language treatment. She would have no idea, right? Even if they appeared false or the language was wrong, she would have no idea to do those things.
Has your client ever in the history of this case argued that these records were not what they purported to be?
So nobody has ever disputed that these seem to be some unverified copy of some of her prior medical records. But again, that question has never been before the court in any of the medical record authentication cases.
Ultimately, there was a COR affidavit eventually produced, right?
So, yes, the district court found that the COR violated the authentication statute, and this was not so much a finding that was unilaterally made. This was admitted by trial counsel. They asked point blank, do you have a set of records that complies with the statute? And they said, no, we don't. This followed days and days and days of discussion about the failure to list these things in pretrial disclosures, the failure to list these things in discovery disclosures, the repeated failures to offer custodian of records affidavits or disclose those things. And the district court, this court has found, 52.325 says that the affidavit must comply with the COR statute 52.260.
But isn't that when you subpoena the records?
So 52.325 mentions subpoenas, but it says the affidavit that authenticates them must comply with 52.260. The court has found that 52.260 includes mandatory language for what is included. And in any event, even if that weren't the case, custodian of records affidavits, both in state court and in federal court, provide carve-out provisions that, so we are required, we're obligated to receive prior notice of the COR so that we can question the veracity of the COR affidavit. That's subsection 4 of NRS 260, but it's the same thing as in the federal rule 902 sub 11. We are permitted to question the veracity, and here consider, again, so that the court's review, of course, is consistent with the record and fact-bound at this point, right? So for 3 years, and it was found, the district court found in the order resolving the motion for new trial that they didn't find out about this 2 days before trial. They had noticed that their records were incomplete for 3 years. So for 3 years, they know they have incomplete records. We repeatedly tell them, you cannot authenticate these things. You do not have a COR. You do not have any personal knowledge.
But didn't they ask your client to produce a complete set of records?
So the request under Rule 34, Rosa's obligation was to give what she had.
Are you saying you didn't have that other page of records? Because it seems like you were referring to it, or your colleague, in the depositions, right?
And so I'm trying not to misspeak. So Justice Lee, I think your question was, did we produce it? Yes, we gave what we had. The question about the last three pages, the district court found that was an inadvertent disclosure. And so in the depositions, the question is not like a gotcha. The last visit is helpful to us.
Right.
The tenor and notice of each of
them. And even after that came up at the deposition, you didn't supplement your response to the request for production.
The district court found that we were not obligated to.
I'm not asking the district court. I'm asking you.
So in the deposition, the question we repeatedly asked, why didn't you do this? Because it's listed in your report. And the answer wasn't anything beyond, I guess I just wasn't given this. So
I'm asking why your client didn't supplement your client's response to the request for production.
Now I understand. So we were not aware that the production did not include these last three pages until the second day of trial. What we surmise, so lots of times, especially in injury litigation, there are documents that are produced and not given to experts for totally benign reasons, right? Especially if you the more complicated injury cases include lots of different records from all over the place. It's not uncommon for an expert to be given something or not given something. It's also, cynically, it's not all that uncommon for experts to overlook things that are harmful to their opinion, which was really the tenor of the cross-examination of both Dr. Wong and Dr. Kuchera.
How did you obtain your client's prior medical records in the beginning?
So I have tried to find this answer out, Your Honor, and the answer is I do not know. The attorneys who handled it no longer work at the firm. The staff doesn't work at the firm. We have different case management software. The old case management software is not backed up well enough for us to find out. So I've tried to find this answer, but I think ultimately, so the answer is I don't know, but ultimately I don't believe it matters, and here's why. So I can't authenticate the records, or any attorney can't authenticate the records. I don't have personal knowledge. So even if I'm giving it, still doesn't authenticate. Rosa certainly doesn't. And I think...
Traditionally, how would you get it?
Typically, it's 50-50. Sometimes it's easier for them to get it. Sometimes it's easier for us to get it. So...
Meaning your client?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Yes, the client.
But I mean, if you got these records in whatever fashion you got them, and I'm sure you had some conversation with your client about it, if you had some concern, like my client only colloquially speaks English, and we're not really sure if this is a complete set or whether they're accurate or what, but I'm providing them to you based on the request for production. I'm sure you would have said something along those lines other than, hey, I'm asked to produce these records, I've got these records, seems like they're the records, and I'm going to produce them.
And that's correct, but I think it it implicates the reason why we're not able to authenticate. If we don't know, if we don't have personal knowledge, a lot of times we wouldn't know what the correct record would look like, right? We would have no idea if it looks flawed or if this person doesn't have personal knowledge, you know, this medical provider doesn't work there or anything like that. So therein lies the problem, which is that
let me ask you a question. So you're trying a case that's just the images, and you're saying you don't know what is in your own client's medical records?
So we certainly knew. We knew definitely by the time of trial. But I'm sort of surmising, just generally speaking.
You produced documents and you didn't know if they were the real records?
We produced the documents that we had in our control and possession. And so, again,
and
I
think you have any obligation to make sure that you're producing accurate records?
I don't. I think our obligation under Rule 34 is simply to provide the documents that are in our possession. And again, I think this goes back to...
Request wasn't for strangers' records. It was for your client's records, right?
Certainly. And so, again, they were probably some portion of her records. But if we look at the court's case law about authentication, that's never been the central question. So in Sanders versus Sears Page... nobody seems to have questioned that those were probably Ms. Sanders' medical records. The question that the court was mostly concerned with is, what process exists? What evidence exists to verify that? There is nobody, because there might be typographical errors or whatever, there's nobody with personal knowledge who can verify that thing. And if I may, I think I'd like to interpose a hypothetical that I think sort of shows why this record or this system becomes unworkable almost immediately. So if Rosa wants to offer a medical record at trial, she's the plaintiff, she has the burden to establish authentication, which means she has no personal knowledge, so she has to offer a COR, either testimony or affidavit. Certainly, this is sort of undisputed, right? If Mr. Gutierrez asks for that same record and she gives it to him, now he does not need a COR, Rosa still does. Which, again, the court said in Noblepi versus El Cortez, the rules are designed to create a level playing field, equality across the board, which seems unequal and is bad. But it becomes similarly absurd almost immediately, because if Rosa asks for the same document back, nobody has any personal knowledge. Rosa hasn't gained any knowledge that would help her authenticate. The document remains the same in all forms. But now she does not need a COR because she has received the document in discovery. So in the course of two discovery requests, we have circumvented the entirety of custodian of records practice. If this were recorded.
It's your client's obligation to produce documents that are within her possession or control. And so those medical records, if they were incomplete, that would be on you and your client, would it not?
The district court didn't find that. The district court found that.
I understand. I'm asking you directly, not what the district court found.
I think your question is, do we have an obligation to produce the entirety of the file? And I think the answer is no, we have the obligation to produce what is in our possession. Again, if the medical records were...
She has control of her medical records.
And I think to that point, Your Honor, if there were lingering questions about this, again, the court found that they knew about this for 3 years before trial. If they had lingering questions or wanted that, there could have been motion to compel practice. They could have, to your point, they could have sent a subpoena and verified this. Most discovery practice is premised on trusting but verifying.
Is it your position that a custodian of records is the only human being on the planet that can authenticate a medical record?
Yes, somebody with personal knowledge, certainly. And
that wasn't my question. I asked is the custodian of records the only person who can authenticate a medical record?
Somebody with sufficient notice to be qualified as a custodian of records, certainly. Not every organization has a...
If you get the doctor down from Align Med and put him on the stand, or her, and ask if it's their records, they can authenticate it, right?
Yes, but that would satisfy... They would then become a custodian of records because they would satisfy the statute about what is a custodian of records. They have notice of how it was made and how the records are kept.
So, but yet, taking your position, then if a custodian of records certifies, I don't know, 4,000 pages of medical records, but the copier misfed and didn't copy one page, then none of that is authenticated?
The COR would be inaccurate. That's what the requirement under 52. So 52.325 says it has to be a complete reproduction. And 52.260 says we're entitled to question the veracity of that document. That we're entitled to it under sub 4. The court said in Gall versus State it's a mandatory requirement. So yes, that is my position. I think
wouldn't that go to completeness rather than authenticity? Though like that isn't the remedy something different than saying these are not authentic documents?
Right, like the records you get are still actual medical records, which is what they purport to be.
But the statute requires that they're a complete reproduction of that thing. The business record itself is not complete and therefore doesn't comply with the statute. And again, I'll reiterate that Sanders versus Sears Page said this is the way to authenticate medical records. And they didn't use that way. And then Sanders versus Sears Page said, well, maybe these other catch-all provisions you could utilize to authenticate medical records. They list 12 parts of Chapter 52. They didn't use any of those. So the question then...
They never had the opportunity because the court told them they couldn't introduce them unless they had the custodian of records.
I think it was backwards. The court repeatedly asked for an offer of proof how they were going to authenticate these documents. And that their answer repeatedly was because they are produced in discovery. And then only the second or third day of trial, they showed up with the custodian of records affidavit and then admitted that it was false. And if I could...
Let me give you an opportunity. Let's assume that we find that the district court erred in excluding these records. Address the prejudice problem, if you would, please.
Thank you. Absolutely. And so I think, again, if we look at the importance, so the fallacy that underlies their argument is that they say these were an important part of their defense. The fallacy that underlies that is that their defense was on equal footing or had a reasonable chance of success, and that is very unlikely. The district court found that since from the beginning, they hired experts who had mutually exclusive defenses. So Dr. Wong says she was not hurt. Dr. Cuchero says she was structurally hurt in a different way than the plaintiff says. In order for that to succeed, the jury is going to have to disregard at least half of their expert testimony. And that's just on face value. Because then when we look to the 2017 records, they also disagree about that. Jeff Wong says her spine just looks degenerative. Cuchera says, oh, I think that was hurt in a different car crash. But either way, prior to the district court excluding the records, the district court was going to enter a limiting instruction that said there is no evidence of pain prior or after discharge in 2017 until this crash. So the 2017 records, in theory, are to say that actually, well, she was hurt prior, right? The medical evidence in this case was that no, every doctor testified, you don't just test that an MRI is just a picture. We don't treat MRIs, we treat symptomatology. There's no evidence that her symptomatology was the same in 2017 to 2019. There was Mr. Corporate mentioned the arm pain. In the evidentiary hearing, it came out that her arm pain in 2017 was a sprained wrist, which is not the arm pain alleged here. So even if the 2017 records came in and the jury could say, hey, she had received prior medical treatment, the salient point is that she had no symptoms until this car crash. And then the defense doctors all uniformly agree that her symptoms start with a car crash. And then on cross-exam, they say that her symptoms match the disc injuries that she claimed. The treatment is indicative of somebody with a disc injury. Her result from surgery, which cures disc injuries, was consistent with somebody who had a disc injury and then underwent surgery. And all of that is irrespective of 2017, because if she's asymptomatic going into this crash, and The crash makes her symptomatic, whether her spine was degenerative or whether it was asymptomatic but was hurt in a car crash, that just makes her an eggshell plaintiff. And as we noted in the briefing, there was an eggshell instruction that said, we're not claiming anything prior to the crash, we are just claiming any change in her symptomatology from this crash. And they never made an offer of proof as to why that would be any different. The district court found that they didn't make any offers of proof regarding how their expert opinions would be different with or without the 2017 records. I'm going a little bit over. I have about 30 seconds. Is that okay? Or I'm happy to sit.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'll be brief. And so because there was an eggshell instruction, the 2017 records were not likely to sway any part of the defense testimony. These arguments were largely waived because even in the motion for new trial, they didn't identify Kuchera's disc protrusion opinion or Jeff Wong's age degeneration opinions as something that were impacted by the exclusion. The evidence that they identified was things that they're now calling cumulative error regarding minor discrepancies in Jeff Wong's testimony and Kuchera's testimony that were caused by their exclusion after the fact. So with that, I'll sit down. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll add a minute, Elizabeth, if you would, too.
I'll start with the hypothetical Mr. Stewart posed, because I think there's an easy solution. Who produced the documents in litigation first? That answers that hypothetical. I want to talk about, well, let me actually talk about Sanders first. So in Sanders, the parties didn't know where the documents came from. The documents were dropped off at the courthouse. And the plaintiff actually testified that, I don't remember if it was he or she, but that he or she didn't really have that treatment. So there was actually a dispute about the authenticity of those documents dropped off at the courthouse. So at that point, it's incumbent upon the plaintiff to, so if a plaintiff produces something, it's incumbent upon the plaintiff to show why those aren't actually real. And let me talk about prejudice. So liability was stipulated in this case. The only issue at trial was causation and damages. And the 2017 records were the basis for both of our experts' opinions on causation. And even the district court agreed this was relevant evidence. Multiple times in the record, the district court is saying this is relevant evidence. Plaintiff did us a favor. If you look at volume 7 of the appendix, beginning at 1736, there's actually a red line of the two expert reports. Well, it's more than two expert reports, but the two experts, plaintiff has gone and struck through all the opinions that our experts weren't allowed to give at trial. And so if you want to look at prejudice, they're full of red lines because both experts were relying on those records. And all the other arguments plaintiff are making are really attempts to discredit those opinions, but that's what a jury trial is for.
Can you tell me how you came to know that those last few pages were missing? How did that first get discovered and by whom?
Yeah, there's transcripts just before trial where defense counsel, I wasn't involved yet, mm-hmm. Defense counsel, I believe, sent emails. I may be conflating 2019 or in 2017, because plaintiff also didn't produce all of the 2019 records. The last three visits for that one were missing as well. And then plaintiff just decided to exclude those records at trial rather than claim damages for them. So shortly before trial, I think defense counsel said, hey, we're missing this record. Where is it? There was discussion in the depositions about the May record, and I think Dr. Wang says, well, I noticed on the billing records there's a May 23rd visit,
okay,
but I don't actually have the record.
Understood, okay.
And so it wasn't actually put together until right before trial.
Okay.
I think the arguments on authenticity and disclosure here both are arguments for empty procedural hurdles. Nobody's arguing that these aren't real records. Nobody's arguing that plaintiff didn't know that we intended to rely on these records. And they were extremely prejudicial to our defense. So we would ask that the court reverse for a new trial, unless there's any questions.
Argument that the only way to authenticate medical records is through a COR affidavit?
Right, it's just not true. So NRS 52.325, first of all, nobody in Nevada is complying with that statute because It's for subpoenaing records. So if you subpoena a record, the way that the custodian record complies with that is actually to send a copy to the court under seal. And that's how you comply with NRS 52.325. So that's not how it's happening. Really what's happening is people are relying on the authentication statute for regularly kept records, which is 52.260. Mm-hmm. And that's what 52.3.25 refers back to. And that is what we went and got here from Align Med. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Council.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time today, for the briefing and the argument. The matter is going to stand submitted to the court, and we will be in recess as well as call the court. Thank you.